The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on November 30th, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Good to see you all today. It was a nice, bright, snow-covered day here. Well, let me just jump into this. I'm just going to read a few passages from here. This is Zen Essence, The Science of Freedom, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. It's a collection of various Zen masters and sayings that they have offered. This first one here, this is from Zen Master Yuan Su. This first one is called The Crowning Meditation. He says, if you do not listen truly, you will call a bell a cup and inevitably wind up adding error to error, talking about Buddha, in quotes, Zen masters, in quotes, mind and essence. How is this different from gouging a wound in healthy flesh? Real Zenists set a single eye on the state before the embryo is formed, before any signs become distinct. This opens up and clears the mind so that it penetrates the whole universe. Then they are no different from the Buddha and the founder of Zen, whoever they are. This is called the crowning meditation, the jewel that reflects all colors, the inexhaustible treasury, the gateway to spiritual powers, the diamond sword, the crouching lion, the blaze. There are various names for it. Now there is nothing in the universe, nothing mundane or beyond mundane, to be an object, an opposite, a barrier, or a hindrance. Okay, that's Zen Master Yuan Su, the crowning meditation. So he says, if you do not listen truly, you will call a bell a cup and inevitably wind up adding error to error. Talking about Buddha, Zen master's mind and essence. And how is this different from gouging a wound in healthy flesh? Yeah, so if you don't listen truly, yeah, we'll call a bell. We have a bell. We have a couple of bells here. You call a bell a cup. What is he saying there? That if we call it a cup, then is it a cup? Can we use it as a cup? Yeah, we could use it as a cup, these bells here that we have. But is it a cup? Looks like a cup. It's kind of a general shape of a cup. Is it a cup? If we listen truly, if we listen now, if it's a bell, isn't there sound? Is there sound? Can we hear the bell? Is it a bell? We rely on words to give us meaning or to explain things or to make us feel like we've captured something, that we understand something, that we've gotten hold of something. But what are these words? And what are they? Are they just sounds? But he says, if you do not listen truly, just listen truly, what, to the teacher's words, to Yuan Su, to his words? Listen to what? But if you do not listen truly, you will call a bell a cup and inevitably adding error to error. Talking about Buddha, he has this in quotes, he's one of these in quotes, Zen masters. Yeah. We say Buddha, then we've captured something here. We have an idea. We have some sense of Buddha. Yeah, is that right? What image you pick up now in your mind? Is this correct or is this an error? Should we not say Buddha or something like that? Or Zen masters? I remember my teacher, Katagiri Roshi, he would, somebody refer to Zen master, maybe refer to him as a Zen master or whatever. He'd just wrinkle up his face and say, no one can master their life. Yeah. And in mind, we speak of mind. Here he has it in quotes, and or essence. We talk about, we use these words, you know. And then we think maybe that we're actually capturing something or relating something, transmitting something. And then when we receive the words too, we think we're receiving something, getting something. But is what I say now, or at any time ever you would say, is that what other people are receiving? Are they truly hearing what is being said? Are you confused in what you are saying? Or is you, are you really speaking truth here? Dharma, reality. Does that go into words? And if it doesn't, I mean, then whatever, are words useless? But look at how much we use words, language, and writings, and speeches, and talks. It's endless. Well, how much of this is capturing anything here? Any real understanding? And we hear these things about enlightenment or, you know, masters. And, well, is this possible? What are we even talking about there? Or when a word is used by you or by someone else, and there are listeners here listening to that word, are you really talking about thinking the same thing? That's questionable. But here he says, real Zenists, he said, they set a single eye on the state before the embryo was formed, before any signs become distinct, before we grasp a sign or the meaning, you know, that might be in the words. Are they in the words? And mean, is it, you have something here, a word, and it means that over there? How well is this working? On the other hand, if we say nothing, you know, as my teacher, you know, Katagiri Roshi, gave that talk, became the title of a book of his, you know, you have to say something. Yeah, can you say it, though? Of course, we can just say, yeah, I just said it, but it. It with a capital I. You get me now? Are we really talking about the same thing here? Are you hearing the same thing? So here we are with language, and yet we feel like the language in our speech and what we're saying and that is really definite and true, and it seems to allow us to function in some way in our society or our culture or whatever. And how well do we function? And is it really, you know, so here we are. But he says, real Zenists, they set a single eye on the state before the embryo is formed, before any signs become distinct. Before something is appearing in there now as a thing. And we can put a label on it now, a name, whatever it might be here. And now we can, it's very handy, very useful. Language is very useful. We can't get along without it. And now we can relate to other people in various ways of discussing this thing or whatever, pointing it out, using language. Very functional, very useful. Yes, absolutely, it is. You have to say something as well, as my teacher said, or nobody will understand if you don't say anything. He said this to me after, when I first started really understanding what we were doing here, and I said, well, we can't talk about this. You have to say something, or no one will understand. So we have to, you know, so I'm saying this now so that you don't think that I'm suggesting we do without language or something. Well, we can't. You know, well, we can, I suppose, but wouldn't be particularly functional and helpful for us, particularly in our complex society now today. You know. So this isn't about doing away with or that's bad or wrong, get rid of it. I'm not talking like this. But on the other hand, too, we can go in the other direction as well here. But where the Zenist, the term he uses here, clearly, I think, well, supposedly translating Yansu here, but Zenists, these true practitioners, whatever, they said a single eye, not two, three, four different eyes, different ways we can look at, look at what? Well, is there something forming now? But before anything forms, they said a single eye, before anything is forming here, before the embryo is formed, before the embryo, not even the fully formed things, but just the coming into appearance here, into existence of something here. Not necessarily the chick in the egg or something like that, but the embryo of anything, a thought, whatever, something's forming there now. Before this occurs, this is where the Zenist, one who's truly practicing this way, this is where they set their mind, their eye. And before anything becomes distinct, he says, this opens and clears the mind so that it penetrates the whole universe. The whole universe. Everything. Perhaps we could say. What is he pointing to there, using a phrase like that, a term like that, the whole universe? Yeah, but if we set the mind before something is forming here, before something, there's something there to grasp or to take hold of, this is where the true Zen practitioner here is. And this is where they set their mind, set their eye. Yeah, and it opens up and clears the mind so that it penetrates the whole universe, he says. Then they are no different from the Buddha and the founder of Zen, or whoever the Buddha, well, as we say the Buddha, we talk about Buddhas and patriarchs, Buddhas, different individuals, and then we talk about the Buddha, that man who lived in India 2,500 years ago or so, given the name of Gautama, the Buddha, the Buddha Shakyamuni, give it another name there, the Buddha of the Shakyas, the Shakya clan, but the historical Buddha. And then we form an idea there. Do we know this guy? Do we know of him? Well, we know the stories. Are those stories true, correct? Have they been misinterpreted? Are there clashing stories where we attribute this to the Buddha or that, or some historical event or this or that? Well, they don't seem to be in sync with each other here. Doesn't this occur? Do we really have a grasp of what the Buddha is? But if you're looking at this thing before the embryo has formed and before it's formed into various distinctions, then they have a mind. There's this seeing that is no different than that of the Buddha. But don't get any ideas about the Buddha. That's just pointing to what. But if you don't say anything to yourself, you don't try to form an image, you know what this is pointing to. A person who's truly, fully, deeply seeing this reality, and the Buddha and the founder of Zen. But exactly who's that person now? The Buddha might seem like that's really becoming pretty distinct, because we know his name was Gautama, even. But of course, if we can keep looking at that, what does that mean? What does that refer to? For each of us sitting here now. Yeah, we all have names. We can learn each other's names. Before we know each other's names, or, maybe it feels a little awkward, or we're a little, we want to know your name. I'd like to know your name so I can refer to you and that sort of thing. Yeah, and then we'll talk. Maybe we think we we know this person, or, you know, and my impression of that person will be the same as your impression, and all of that. But it's never pinned down. It's never solid in the way that we'll kind of just, I don't know, glibly go through life or whatever, just thinking we've gotten a hold of various things here, that we know this, we know that, or we know that person, or whatever. Yeah. But if they can just see and act, you know, before the embryo has formed, yeah, then they're no different from Buddha. So this isn't some particular person, even the person here now who can see in this way, that they're no different from the Buddha or the founder of Zen or whatever. And he says that this is called the crowning meditation, the jewel that reflects all colors, the inexhaustible treasury, the gateway to spiritual powers, the diamond sword, the crouching lion, the blaze. And he says there are various names for this. Yeah, and I could take each one of these and, you know, start pulling it apart. You can too, you know. But the crowning meditation, that's the title of this little piece here. You can just maybe settle for that one there. The meditation. What is the meditation? What do we mean by meditation? And various forms that people will take and call that meditation, or ideas that they'll have. You know, when my book on meditation now or never, I around the Swedish edition of it, that came out with somebody. You know, it was a woman sitting on a dock on a beautiful setting there, and kind of her legs hanging over the dock and kind of crossed at the ankles, and she had her head thrown back, and I don't know, it was often this gesture is made with both hands, you know, the thumb touching with the middle finger maybe, and or the index, I don't know, and head thrown back. Whoever designed the cover had just read the book, they would have realized that I described the form of meditation, the sitting form. It was nothing like that picture of the woman on the dock in this blissful state. But it's that kind of captures what people maybe just kind of think of meditation. Oh, yeah, something like that. She had her cup of Javalia there. It was a Swedish edition, so... But it was a cup of coffee there, sitting next to her on the dock, and you know. Anyway, so we'll say meditation, and there's maybe all kinds of meditation. But this crowning meditation then would suggest maybe this is really what meditation is here. Yeah, and then it's also called the jewel that reflects all colors and inexhaustible. And this is, there are many, you know, various names, you know, for this. I won't go into these various things, but each one would bring out a different quality or a different aspect of it. And of course, we might hang on to this or hang on to that as we hear it. But there we're letting the embryo form, and something's becoming distinct and separate. It's all very liquid, you know, life is just flowing on through all the time, continuously. And be careful to maybe not to grasp things or to hold them too tightly or to freeze them out, you know, so you can get a grip on them and that sort of thing. That's killing. That's gouging. Oh, I was going to say about gouging the wound in healthy flesh. Yeah. And we don't need to do that. We can see and know, just pointing to the Buddha, you know, without actually grasping the Buddha or whatever else we might be talking about, or trying too hard to suggest something like, well, this is a book on meditation, so it must mean you're just sort of a blissed out thing. No, well, read the book first, maybe, but also... Even then, don't grip anything here. You know what all of this is. And it'd be like, you know, I've used the expression often, you know, the tasting orange juice, you know. And if you meet up with someone who's never seen an orange or tasted orange juice or whatever, and you're going to try to describe the taste of orange juice, well, you can just imagine. You can't do it. You can't do it. But what would our intention there be? Was to somehow get hold of it here and hand that to this other person so that they would have the taste of orange juice. They would know that. But of course, they can't know it in that way. And, you know, through the language, through the word, you know, but what I'm trying to suggest here, what I think we're looking at here, is that we can't get hold of anything, really. I mean, it can seem like it, and we have an idea, and we have something gripped and fixed and that sort of thing. But be very careful with that. And allow that to flow and to move and to change, and maybe suggest, you know. But if you're going to taste orange juice, then you have to taste orange juice. That's all there is to it. You're not going to get it into words and pass it along that way or receive it that way, you know. So, but this is called all these various things. He said, but now there is nothing in the universe. So if we can see, taste, know, realize in this way without having gripped anything at all in particular. Isn't that true? We'll think the knowing is in the gripping. Once I get a grip on this, oh, no, I know what this is, and I know how it relates to that and other things over here. That's conceptual knowledge. But it's constructed knowledge. It's limited in various ways, and it is relational with other sorts of things and that sort of thing. But true knowledge is not in what it is that we can grip and take hold of and then maybe convey that to someone else. Of course, I'm talking now, and maybe you'll receive this as though I'm saying some specific thing, but I don't really intend that to be the case. But just pointing to how it is we directly experience virtually everything. And the real tasting of it is going to be in not gripping it, not taking hold of it, not forming it. And then maybe using this, maybe make your variation of it and then try to relay that to other folks. This is how we'll carry on. But this is to start losing track of what it is that we're tasting here, experiencing here. So he says, now there is nothing in the universe, nothing mundane, just ordinary sort of things, or beyond mundane, to be an object. Nothing here to be an object, a barrier, or a hindrance. There's nothing here, if without our gripping and taking hold of it, there's nothing here that's a barrier or an object. Of course, there's also, there's no object, no subject either. This sense of me here experiencing this and tasting this and all of that, that's all kind of manufactured, and it's not the full flavor, the full taste, the full knowing, because that is in the perceptual, in what is not gripped. Yeah, and then also this crowning meditation here, then, as this section is called, this is basically, and Dogen speaks of this in Genjo Koan, you know, this is just think not thinking. Yeah, this is the crowning meditation, is to think this, not thinking. And how do you think not thinking? He says, well, then he says, not thinking. what is that exactly? But it is just this very thing that I haven't really said. At least I don't feel like I have. If I was listening to what I was saying here, I wouldn't feel like I've really said anything specific here. But pointing, trying to draw your attention to really noticing the richness and the fullness, but also the incredible subtlety of actual immediate direct experience and the true knowing and understanding of life and reality is in that. Not in the boxed up stuff that we conceptualize and put labels on in exchange for reality and that sort of thing. So I think that's what Master Yuan Tzu is trying to say to us here. Do you have any questions about anything I said there? If not, I'll just go on with another one. He's got another one here that caught my eye as well. I'll go through this a little more quickly, I think, but the last line is what I want to get to. But it's, four paragraphs before we get... There's short paragraphs. But this one, this is also by Yuan Tzu here. He says, it's titled Distortion by Teachers. So here I am. Am I a teacher? And all of this distorting I've been doing, I've kind of hinted at the fact that, don't get a grip on anything here. But here he has this piece, Distortion by Teachers. We'll take a look at that. Because even with teachers, even a Buddha, the one who's fully awakened, if they say something, yeah. You know why the world is mysterious to us? Don't you think it's mysterious? Like it's all a mystery. In the end, you ponder this or that and whatever, and it's all kind of, yeah, it's because we keep it in the conceptual. And as long as you do that, it's just gonna, the backdrop of it will be mystery. It's strange, you know, mysterious, can't grip it, you know. And then we take that, our inability to really grip it and get hold of it as it's kind of mystery or something like that. Well, if we don't try to take hold of it, there's no mystery. It's all very clear. But anyway, here's the distortion. But as soon as we say something, no, it's like we're taking hold of it. We're using words and got a grip, you know. So this is related to the other piece I just read here. Distortion by teachers. The one road beyond, now this is in quotes, though, one road beyond in quotes. I'll just say it. The one road beyond is vast as cosmic space times 10. It cannot be sought with mind. It cannot be attained by mindlessness. It cannot be reached by words. Yeah. Lin Chi or Rinzai, he talked about the lull of words. That's what we're kind of looking at in that last piece that we had. Yeah, we start to use the words and it kind of lulls us to sleep or at least so we don't really realize what we're actually tasting, what's actually being lived out. We're kind of living out a little play that we have running in our mind that we're writing out as we go. But anyway, so he says, so this road beyond, the one road beyond is vast as cosmic space times 10, cannot be sought with them. It's not an object. It's not something you're going to be able to, you know, to go for. It cannot be attained by mindlessness, but just bring your mind to this right here. But of course the mind isn't going to, you know, capture anything that the mind captures, your mind captures, my mind captures. This is going to be a distortion. You know, it cannot be reached by words, as we're looking at. It cannot be understood, and yet it cannot be understood by silence. As my teacher said, you have to say something. So the essential point is for the individual to be sound of mind and see right through the state before the embryo is formed. Well, just referring to that image there too. And before any signs become distinct. Passing through the heights and the depths, escaping all traps, ranging over all time, totally without attachment and repulsion, free in all ways. When you attain great independence, you have some measure of accord with the one road beyond. That's, again, that opening phrase, the one road beyond. So with this, it's free in all possible ways, neither gripping nor just letting go. If you rely or dismissing or something like that, if you rely on the differences in teachers and see the differences in persons, you are misled by blind teachers into reifying Buddha, Dharma, Zen, Tao, mysteries, marvels, functions, and states. One way and another, this glues your tongue down, nails your eyes shut, and constricts your heart. Yeah. So this thing that what he's saying here, that if you're misled by blind teachers and reifying the Buddha, or Dharma, Zen, Tao, mysteries, you're making these into something. All of these things. We'll do that, of course, with everything. We'll make it into something. In our mind, it is something. You know, that Zafu there, that's something. But also the thought I have, the idea I have about this or that, the feeling I have, that's something, yeah. And we make all of these things. This is what our conceptual mind, we're making all of these things, these objects then, that are reflecting or relating to me, the subject here, for each of us, you know, and And but this all becomes solid and real and distinct. And we're completely lost in that imagery and that kind of understanding without realizing the utter fluidity of the whole thing, where you can't pick out or get hold of any one thing at all. So, yeah, so he says, glues your tongue down and nails your eyes shut and constricts your heart, he says. Like oil getting into flour, this becomes deeply ingrained in us until you eventually become something special. I'm adding that. But you eventually become, you become something distinct and special. Yeah, special and apart from those over there, and maybe I'm special and I'm better or something like that, or maybe I'm not as good, and I don't like that. But we make ourselves into something like this or that, and all of that just becomes utterly real for us, But it's just like getting oil into flour. This becomes deeply ingrained in us, and eventually we become, we become, he says, a sprite or a ghoul, emanating countless lights, that's in quotes, and manifesting countless psychic powers. Yeah. Thinking that you are peerless in all the world. Yeah. Yeah, without peers, something really very special here. So he said that this is what is meant by the saying, our perception, this is the line I wanted to get us to. But this is what is meant by the saying, our perception is originally correct, but it is distorted by teachers, he says here. That's interesting. So I apologize to the extent that I'm distorting this. But it is pointing. So if you don't grip anything I'm saying here, then I won't be distorting it. But that'll have to be your responsibility at that point. I'm just saying in my own heart and mind, I'm not offering this. Here's something now for you to grip. This is just pointing something out for us and for me too, But this is what is meant by the saying, our perception is originally correct. Perception. We confuse perception with conception. We get the idea, the concept of this or that or whatever, the thingness of something, the distinction. The embryo is formed and it's distinct and different from something else over here that it's also forming. We don't really pay attention to the fact that, this continuous forming means there's nothing forming here. You can't pin down anything that's actually forming, but yet here it is. There appears to be form. It appears to be subject, object. Yeah, that's the dynamic, untouchable reality that's being lived out. But we keep making every aspect of it, including me, into something solid and real and distinct and separate. Not realizing that that's the conceptual, that's our conceptual constructs of everything. But the perceptual, the actual immediate direct experience before anything is formed, this is our perceptual experience. Yeah, and what he says here is our perception is originally correct. That, and to wake up to this, this is what awakening is. This is what the Buddhas, this is what they see. Those who wake up, they finally can see what is there originally, which doesn't have a distinct form. And I've been hinting here and there in what I've been saying this morning and to the ways in which these distinct forms and things seem to be appearing here. We get lost in that, lost in the lull of words that we'll use to identify this or that or the next thing. But he says, so this is what is meant by that our perception is originally correct, but it is distorted by teachers. Well, it could be people, things, but other things can teach us as well. Various experiences of this or that. But teachers, by using words as I'm doing now, that'll distort, so don't grip them too tightly, the words I'm using. I'm just trying to help you for you to turn your head or whatever to realize the actual fluid experience of what is taking place here. But this distortion is in thought. And then in the conceptualizing that we do, we immediately conceptualize our experience. The immediate experience is perceptual. we immediately, instantly, on that, with the perception, we conceptualize it. We turn it into thing. We feel very uncomfortable until we get it into the form of a thing that now I can label and recognize and relate to and all of that. But this is the distortion. If we don't do that, then there's no mystery. There's nothing here to puzzle over. This is also why, and I've used this a number of times, you probably know the phrase from your own reading, perhaps, in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, where Suzuki Roshi, you know, says that there's no need to remember what I said after he'd been giving a talk or whatever. No need to remember what I said. well, then why did you say it? Why did you bother? You know, yeah. But yeah, it's just like, it's kind of like that. I've kind of gone over, I don't know. Question. I also have, when I picked up this book, I noticed I had this bookmark in here. I want to just give this to you quickly, because it's also related, I think, in some ways to what I've been trying to point to this morning. And this is by John Blofeld, who did a very famous translation of Huang Po. Anyway, he says here, the ambiguity of a word like xin, that's H-S-I-N, xin, or X-I-N, if you're, I used to know, one is pinyin and one is Wei Giles, and back when I was studying Chinese over 40 years ago now, it's unbelievable, I forgot how long it's been. Anyway, my Chinese is very poor now. But anyway, but this is an incredible word, xin, xin. It's like an S-H, but kind of a sh, sharper, sh, xin. And it shows up in xin xin ming. Xin xin ming, there's the ambiguity right there. Xin means heart or mind. And so that poem by Sen Tsang, you know, the xin xin ming, that's trusting heart mind. So anyway, but the ambiguity, but this is interesting here. The ambiguity of a word like xin is admirable because in Buddhism, not only are your mind, my mind, his mind, her mind, uncreated immortal mind, and he's referring to mind, that I would capitalize that mind. Mind, sometimes we say big mind or something like that, but it's just mind. But that's different than your mind or my mind, which I wouldn't capitalize that. But here, it's this ambiguity here, it's admirable because in Buddhism, not only are your mind, my mind, his mind, her mind, uncreated immortal mind, known to be one in reality, but mind, minding, and the thing minded, the thing thought about, are also held to be one and the same. So this is quite interesting, and they have this word xin that kind of captures all of that. If you think that these things are distinct and different and separate from each other, now there's, you know, there's confusion there, and there's mystery in the world. And that's why most of us are puzzled by the world. We don't quite know what's going on. We form our reality for ourselves and try to expand that and push that on others, and sometimes we gain a certain amount of power in the world so we can really influence other people and the cultures and that sort of thing, and then we think that that's so wonderful and powerful, but it's all delusion. And at the backdrop of it all is, you can, of course, we can acquire wealth and power and stuff like this, and you're not even thinking about something like that. You know, you're going to die, you know. What about that? And that'll be a mystery for you, if you know, because you can occupy yourself so much that you might not pay attention to, you know, realities like that. But the reason it's a mystery, it's not really a mystery if we wake up, if we, you know, set our eye on that which is there before it is formed, the embryo has formed, and the thing has become something distinct. Now the world freezes out in various ways, but you still have some motion there and movement, and things are crashing into each other and that sort of thing. This is going on. It appears to be going on. But if we can see, this is the perceptual, just pay very careful attention to what the perceptual is. You know, that isn't knowing the taste of orange juice. But the moment you try to conceptualize it so you can convey that to somebody else through a word or whatever, now there's going to be confusion. There won't be an understanding that gets conveyed in that way. It is in the immediate experience, before we make anything of it, we can wake up to that. We might think, well, until I make something of it, it isn't anything. Well, it isn't anything particular, but here it is. And in its movement and in its momentariness, there's the reality. And there's nothing there called you that's separate from that. Well, that's when you're conceptualizing, that's how it appears, yeah. But if we can set the mind at that point before we do this, before the embryo starts to form and all of that, then we're tasting as a Buddha tastes and all of that. Well, anyway, I've gone long enough. I better stop. Any questions about anything I said here? Yes. Okay, I didn't. I got you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would you equate awe as part of the conceptual world, or would you equate it with mystery?
The feeling of awe that can come up when we're still kind of rooted in the conceptual. But we can brush up against the sense of really opening up of this, what can I say, totality. We get some sense of that. It can kind of sweep over us a bit. Yeah, and that can leave us with a sense of awe, definitely. Yeah. That can leave us with this sense of awe. We get this sense of awe.
We're still.
If we fully taste it, there's, in a way, it's there's nothing awesome about it. It is very kind of almost mundane in a way, and how it's always been. But that is it's a wonderful feeling. I've known that, and I don't know if I want to say too much about my experience, but if you have that experience about, and oftentimes it could be in experiencing something more particular. Though it could be just in very general terms, nothing particular, but we just have this feeling. Just don't make anything of it. Don't say, and maybe run out and tell people and how great this is and how wonderful or whatever. Just note it and let it go. Yeah.
I picked up a book about awe, which is kind of led me to wonder about that. By a researcher from out of Berkeley, and I haven't read the whole book, but that's what linked it to mystery, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the mystery is there as soon as we try to make something of it, you know, and explain it or whatever, you know, and now it's, why can't it, because I could taste it so well, and it was so vibrant and all of that, yeah. And that can leave us kind of puzzled a bit. But now that's an indication that we're still trying to grasp, or still caught up in the grasping. If we can truly just see before the embryo is forming, before it was any, and we don't even expect or want something to form. Because at some point you can start to see how all the things that are formed are illusory, and its delusion is that we grasp them. You know, but we still live in this world. You know, and that's why Katagiri said to me, well, you have to say something. There's still the appearances of this and that. And that's what we live with. That's what reality is. And this is not nothing. That's just obvious. So here we are, but now how do we live in it? How do we treat it, you know? And where we can do this with freedom. And the mind is free. Yeah, that's what this is. So it is, and just don't make anything of anything, you know, beyond the practicality of, you know, just some small movements here. don't try to acquire too much power or anything like that. Yeah. Did I see a hand here? Or, yeah. Yeah.
And when we say there's nothing outside of wholeness.
No, there's nothing outside of wholeness.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the sense of it. I'm saying, well, there's nothing outside of wholeness. Well, but what kind of a whole is that if there's still something outside? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the conceptualizing is not wrong. It's not bad. It's not something we should do away with. See, now we're back in dualism again. I didn't say anything like that. But the conceptual is something other than the perceptual. I didn't say that the perceptual is better than the conceptual. But it's just that when we're caught, when we're caught, huh?
It's implied that the perceptual is the thing we need to understand.
No, don't drop.
I've been here for a long time and I still don't.
Yeah, I've said this repeatedly, Catherine, that the conceptual is not bad. This isn't about dropping. We have to have, I've said it this morning even, we have to have it. Also, Katagiri said, you have to say something. That's the conceptual. You have, because when I first realized this sort of stuff, I also was speechless. He wanted me to give a talk, and I said, well, we can't talk about this. And he said, well, no, you have to. And for the next 10 years, it was very difficult for me to say anything. But eventually, we can talk. But at no point, because this is very clear in my mind, at no point am I ever saying that the conceptual is bad or wrong or we have to drop it. We can't drop it, for one thing. So it isn't something like that. And the perceptual embraces the whole thing, including the conceptual. You know, so that's important. This is very important. This goes to the very heart of where we get confused, because we think in dualistic terms. So there's perceptual and conceptual, and the perceptual is better, and the conceptual is not. You know, and that's not the way to. I don't hold that at all. I haven't for decades, and so I'm not talking that way. But it does come out as we're using language.
Yeah.
Language is already. Kind of, well, it's conceptual right there.
When you say things like no self and no separation, it gives people this notion that we're all joined at the hip or something, that we're not distinct individuals with distinct abilities, distinct...
There's no not. We can't say that we're not individuals, that we're not distinct.
Right.
Yeah. But you also, we can't say that we are. You know, we are individual and we are distinct. No, and that's the hard part. The part that we're completely lost in without any kind of balance to it is the idea that, yeah, I'm separate and distinct from all of you and everything else, and there's me, you know. Okay, yeah, to some degree, yeah, that's how it appears. That seems like it, but that's not the whole thing. The whole thing is, well, I can't, that's an appearance. I can't be, there isn't some me that is separate from other things. It's not joined at the hips to other, because there aren't other things to be joined with or separated from. It's never a matter of saying that this is, and that is. It's just that you can't say this is, you can't say that is, you can't, but you also, you can't say that is not. You can't say, this is Nagarjuna's tetralemma now. You know, you can't say is, you can't about anything or existence itself. You know, you can't say is, you can't say is not, you can't say both is and well that is and is not. Well, no, but that's kind of a contradiction. And you can't say neither. It's neither. It neither is nor is not. You can't say anything. There's nothing we can say about reality, but we can see it. Not as an object. That's why I italicize it when I use see in that way.
Yeah.
There was a thing in the discussion group, the last discussion group we had on Wednesday night about no self, because I brought up that it's not been attributed to the Buddha that he said there's no self, it's that you don't find a self.
Yeah, we don't find a
self. Someone was, you know, saying, I've never heard that.
I know, it gets lost. It's in my book, Buddhism Plain and Simple.
We don't
find a self. If you look very carefully at what do you think you're referring to when you refer to a self, you're referring to a formed thing that the embryo has formed now, and it's, you know, that would be a self. We don't find that. So there's no self. No, we don't say that. But it's because we're holding to something here now, and we say, well, you can't say that. Then we assume, without anybody saying it, well, then you mean that there's no self. But the Buddha never said that there's no self.
Okay.
All of his teaching has gone into pointing out the fact that we can't actually pin this down. You can't say it. You can't say there's a self. You can't say there's no self.
Is there time for one more question?
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
What's an example of nothing arises, persists, or ceases, if I'm even asking that, right?
Well, yeah, you see that what you're asking me to do is, how can I put this, to form something and then to show how, you know, that it neither arises. You know, it's requiring that we create the very thing that the awakened are trying to help us notice, that we never have something like that. We don't have a formed thing. We have the appearance of formed things. And, you know, so it's not nothing. And that literally means, so this is not nothing here. The appearance of a thing, you know, or, and then of course with that thing out there, now there's me here viewing it or hearing it or whatever. But if you look carefully at this whole thing, the entire thing is fluid and continuously flowing and changing, you know, and there's never any formed thing here in the first place, you know. On the other hand, so we say, well, then there's no formed thing, like, as if, what, there's nothing? No, that's obviously not the case, too. This is not nothing, you know. So then it must be something. No, if you think this is something, you get hold of it, and you can't. It's a matter of just seeing this. The perceptual experience is giving you what I just pointed out now. But there it is. But we, like I said, we immediately conceptualize the experience, and now we think that there are actually things. We can't say there's actually things. So let me finish this. We can't say that there are actually, we can say it, of course, but you can't say that there are actually things. And then of course, because we think that there are things, then you hear it as, well, then you're saying then that there aren't things. Well, we can't say there aren't things. Look around us here. You know, we can't say that there aren't things. Well, but then you're saying that there might. See, in the mind, the conceptual mind is always leaping from one extreme to the other. One extreme to the other. With the perceptual, you see the whole thing. And we don't throw away the conceptual. We don't throw away the well, the perceptual isn't a, but it's the is and is not of it all. The perceptual is the totality. But the conceptual is where we break everything up, and now we appear to have objects and subjects, or, well, me mainly, for each of us. You know, I'm the subject. And, yeah. But this is, if we just look at all of this, see all of this together, this is how the mind is working. This is life. This is reality. This is its nature. It is of this nature. And you can't get hold of any aspect of it, either the is aspect or the is not aspect.
Okay.
And that's what the awakened wake up to. And they don't wake up to it as an idea. I've maybe given you an idea of this now or something, but it's a matter of viscerally, directly realizing it and seeing that this is what experience is. And along with that, you will see that it can't be any other way. And there's a lot behind that, but I obviously don't have time for that now. But don't try to grasp any of this. Just listen, and when the listening is over, you can kind of forget about it. Things might cross your mind here and there, but don't pick up anything or dwell on it or try to figure anything out here. When I finally realized this, I didn't figure anything out. It suddenly just hit me. It seemed like it came out of nowhere, but I'd been working hard at this practice for quite a while by that time. On the other hand, I don't want to say the practice will take you there. Nothing really, I don't know how this works. But at some point we can realize it. But it is a matter of realizing it in a non-intellectual way, a non-conceptual way.
Thank you so
much. Thank you. Well, we have gone over, so I guess we better end it here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.